From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents A Conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything that's in the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for June the 25th, 2017. This is our weekly look at the politics and policies that shape your life from Chicago to Springfield all the way to Washington, D.C. Time to grab the Sunday paper, get that cup of coffee. You might want a hot cup of coffee this morning, a little chillier than we're used to out there, but a beautiful Sunday. So get that cup of coffee, and we'll try and get your day and your week off to a great start. Well, want to welcome back the great Dave Schwann after going on a road trip Ooh. With his dad to celebrate Father's Day up in Michigan and up in Wisconsin, and he even talks with an accent now.
Oh, well, good morning, Rick.
Yes.
It's good to be back with all of you.
Okay, Ole. Thanks so much. We'll be counting on you for the
NHL. It's a very nice day outside, hey? We actually did have a server in a restaurant say, oh, it's a nice night out, hey?
Well, and I assume you encountered a lot of the locals up there.
Oh, had to. We did, especially in a small town we stopped in for lunch. A very French word, Lens.
Lens.
L apostrophe A N S E. Lens. Any idea what that means? You're fluent in French.
I do not know what that means.
It means the cove.
The cove.
And it certainly stands to reason because. They've got a wonderful little park in the downtown area there and a playground in a cove where Lake Superior meets the shoreline there. It's a beautiful view from there. You have this little cove, what looks like the water coming in a little nook mm-hmm. area, and you look out and the lake becomes vast. It just goes
yes.
on into the horizon and into infinity. But, yes, we encountered some locals there who were really a great group of people and otherwise other locals up in Copper Harbor, Michigan, and Houghton, Michigan, in that area there. Great, great people.
Well, and,
and a great trip.
I'm sure your dad had a great time as
oh,
well.
Oh, he certainly did. Yeah, he of course, dad talks to everybody. And so that's the one thing about when you go on these trips and you go to areas like this, you make friends right away. And because of the fact that we were on an island, which is a national park for roughly a week, and not a terribly crowded place either. We hear stories about the big parks like Yosemite and Yellowstone being crowded sometimes, even a little traffic congestion. I've seen reports of that in Yosemite. Not the case here. So, because of the fact that you're in a rather small, isolated area, and there are not a lot of people there, you get to know your neighbors very quickly.
Well,
so
well,
it was a great time to do that.
Plus, one of the greatest things, as you said, was the fact that while you were out on that island, no TV.
How about it?
No Wi-Fi. No cell phone service.
That's right. That's right. I kept looking at my phone, and it was telling me, searching for service. That's what it was telling me.
But it was quiet.
Oh, the only thing you heard was a bird, the wind, and the waves lapping at the shore. That was it.
That's a great way to spend a week, I have to tell you.
Let's have a moment of silence.
That's, truly, what a way to spend the week and just to tune everything
off.
Oh,
it's therapeutic.
Well,
it's therapeutic.
I said when I saw you this morning, you look very, very refreshed. And in fact, you did look a bit harried, but only because it seemed like all of a sudden life had hit you smack dab right in the face
yeah.
again.
When we hit Expressway at Green Bay, Wisconsin, and it was, oh, okay, back to reality here.
back to the grind.
Yeah.
Oh, well. And I have to tell you, you asked, what did you miss? I mean, there were a couple of things, but as far as politics, stalemate continues in Springfield,
oh, yeah.
as
yeah.
expected. But,
And in Washington.
And in Washington, yes. The new Senate version of the Senate Republican version of the health care plan, and we'll be touching on that, but already creating some dissent. Vice President Pence was here briefly in the city yesterday and speaking to top Republicans and telling them that now is their time to replace Obamacare, even though as it stands right now, it lacks the needed votes. But we've got some changes with my Blackhawks. I mean, yeah. I don't know if you've caught up with that.
Yeah. Well, as I mentioned off the air, I heard about Marian Hossa.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's devastating. And I mean, Andy, there were times last year where he looked like he had found the fountain of youth.
Yeah. The guy is 38,
right,
and was an example for pretty much everybody on that team. The way to do things professionally, the way to do things on the ice and off the ice, and what a bulldog with the puck. I mean, this guy, I always wept and felt bad for the guy that stole the puck from Hossa, because nine times out of ten, that puck was coming right back on Marion's stick.
Absolutely. And then Hossa would be right by him.
Yeah, he would fly by him at 38 years of age, yeah, and just like leave him in the dust. And it's such a sad thing. If indeed he did play his last NHL game, this will probably go down as one of, if not the best, free agent signings ever in Chicago sports history.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, destined, obviously, to the Hall of Fame, I think.
I would agree. 525 career goals.
Absolutely. But just the epitome of the two-way player.
And the epitome of a pro. I mean, you hear that word thrown around a lot, and you know, obviously they get paid, so they're pros. But there's a pro's pro. And that's certainly what Hossa is. I don't want to say was yet, because obviously he hasn't retired yet, and the Hawks have some financial figuring to do at this point, whether or not to put him on what they call the long-term injury list, where they can save some money under the cap, which they obviously need. But again, they're going to try to do what's best for the organization here, and they certainly made some changes other than Hossa.
Yes,
as well.
They did. Well, yeah. Artemi Panarin is gone. Now he's gone, but we got Brandon Saad back, which, you know, that was kind of, I kind of get it, because I actually was surprised that Panarin was older than Saad, and so you're buying a little bit more youth, you're buying back a guy who basically helped ignite Jonathan Toews,
mm-hmm,
and Toews, you know, has had some scoring difficulties. I know that getting rid of Panarin on its face might look like it hurts Patrick Kane, but I think anybody could feed Patrick Kane. No offense to Panarin.
Yeah, you know? None to him as well. But, you know, the thing that's the key about what the Blackhawks did there is they got a guy back in Saad who knows the situation, he knows the program, he knows what's expected, he knows Q, he knows the guys he's coming into the dressing room with, but he's a guy that plays both ways. He's been compared to, and again, it's a very unfair comparison, but he's been compared to like a Hossa type of a guy that is a grinder and a guy that's going to get camp himself out in front of the net. And Q loves the greasy goals.
Right,
those are the ones
exactly.
Right in front of the net where you work hard to free yourself and get some tip-ins and those kind of things, which was sorely lacking from what the Hawks were doing in the last couple of years. But, you know, with Panarin gone, Anisimov is still around. And this is a second-line center that finally was able to keep up with Patrick Kane. No offense to the guys that tried it before. Brad Richards had some pretty decent success with it, too. But, you know, Michael Hanzus and those kind of guys have come and gone. Anisimov is one of those guys that certainly has proven he can keep up.
Yeah, but now then we get to Nick Chalmerson.
Yeah.
And I got to tell you, you know, I don't think I've ever seen any defenseman just willing to sacrifice his body in a way to block those shots. And that has been so critical for the great defense that the Blackhawks mm-hmm. have had. And that's going to – I think that's going to hurt.
It's going to hurt in some respects. I think, and I may be in the minority here of this opinion, you know, he's only 30 years old, which, you know, it doesn't seem like it's that old in hockey parlance. But think about all the games that he has played over the course of his short career, which is about nine years at this point. But the thing that I worry about is how many pucks he's blocked
right.
and what kind of a toll that's taking on on his body. We saw him countless times with the head down and the
hunched over and trying to get over. One leg trying to skate exactly. over the bench.
I mean, to his credit, he missed a shift, maybe a shift and a half, and got right back out there. But you know, you have to at some point, if it's not working, you have to try to fix it. And you've got a great core group of people. You've got a general manager who certainly understands the salary cap and the restrictions that it provides in the NHL and has been very adept into working around it. You know, it's not a rebuild. It's kind of a reload situation here with you do have to replace some key guys, but at the same time, you got to give others a chance.
Well, and I've been kind of, you know, that the day of those trades, and I'm kind of trying to assimilate them in my mind.
They came rapid fire, too.
Yeah, and then I saw there was this talk about, well, the Hawks are going after T.J. Oshie mm-hmm. in Washington. And yeah. I'm going, oh, well, that could change things a lot. Yeah. And then that evening, he re-signs with Washington. And it's like, okay, so now what's next?
Yeah, and we're going to hear from Stan Bowman during the morning here about what exactly is next. And July 1st is the next big date, and that's free agency. And, of course, things will be hopefully worked out by then with the Hossa situation and what the cap hit is. So I don't think necessarily he's done dealing.
Because, I don't think so either.
Because he's still over at this point. I mean, even after all those moves, the Hawks are still $1.4 million over the salary cap as we speak right now.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a stay tuned component mm-hmm. when it comes to the Blackhawks, and I'm actually honoring the new entry into the NHL today, the Vegas Golden Knights.
Yes, you are.
And I do like the logo.
The logo's cool.
But Andy and I were talking off the air, but the sweaters are kind of...
I didn't get it. I think you and I were in agreement about the red stripe.
Yeah.
I did read something.
The red sleeve stripe.
And I can't remember what the significance is. There's you know, these days when a new team comes in, there's always significance to whatever color scheme and whatever piping or those kind of things that they use. I'll have to look back and see if I can dig up that article about what it said about their sweaters.
I mean, it's black and gold, mm-hmm. and then obviously white away, and then red. But maybe it's black and red. That's what you bet on.
Yeah, it could be. You know, the roulette tables, and yeah, you know, yeah. Maybe.
Who knows?
That's a good thing. I'll check that out.
Let me know if we find out.
Do you think they'll have roulette and blackjack at the arena? You know, if you step out between period breaks, you can get in a couple of hands.
Yeah, if the game's a blowout, you know, to go out there
That's
and
right.
work the tables.
Yeah.
Now, that could be it. If you were pulled as the goalie, you have to go work one of the blackjack tables.
We should do the show from there.
Now, there's an idea.
October 24th would be a really good day to think about doing it. I'm not sure what day of the week.
Yeah, I was just going to say, what day of the week is that?
Maybe you should just pretend that it's Sunday.
I think every day is Sunday.
Yeah, we'll do a delayed broadcast.
I think that's a great idea. We might need a delay if we're out there anyway.
Yes. Yeah, we'd like to be delayed for a little bit.
Good
yes.
call.
All right. I'm looking into that. Okay.
All right.
This sounds like a great idea. Well, obviously, a lot of things going on in Chicago. It's Pride Parade Day that kicks off at noon, and so obviously Dave will have all the information on that with all the street closures that are going on for that. Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Andy Mazur's got all of the sports. Producer Jasmine's here to field your phone calls at 312-981-7200. You can text us there at 312-981-7200. Engineer Bob is checking out the grocery ads for barbecuing on the grill on this beautiful Sunday. Remember, if you have to tune away, you can find our shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. Up ahead today, we'll be speaking with Republican State Senator Jason Barrickman from Bloomington. He's been actively involved in the Republican version of attempts to rewrite the state's school aid formula. Dave will be back with a news update at 8, and then we'll speak to Lou Lang, the Deputy Majority Leader in the House, a Democratic State Representative from Skokie, get his perspective on what's going on with that special session down in Springfield. We were supposed to have Senate Republican Leader Christine Rodonio on the program at 8:30, but unfortunately she was called away for business, so we have the Deputy Republican Leader in the State Senate, Bill Brady, joining us at 8:30. So that's all coming up ahead. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on a sunny Michigan Avenue this morning. It's time for our weekly spin through national politics, and Republicans won two special congressional elections in Georgia last week, including one in the Atlanta suburbs that was one of the most expensive congressional races in history. But that hasn't stopped some Democrats from looking to challenge Republicans. In southern Wisconsin, ironworker Randy Bryce has announced a Democratic challenge to Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan of Janesville. He's even out with some ads. Here's a portion of Randy Bryce's announcement.
I work every day so that me and my son have insurance. I've been an ironworker for 20 years. I work hard and I earn every penny that I make. And I know everybody that I work with is the same way. I've spent my entire life in southeastern Wisconsin. I can see what people need. I could do so much more, and I will do so much more, taking my voice, taking our voice, and what we need to Washington, D.C. I decided to run for office because not everybody's seated at the table, and it's time to make a bigger table. I'm the best person to represent this district because I'm a working person. If somebody falls behind, we're so much stronger if we carry them with us. That's the way I was raised. You look out for each other. I think it's time. Let's trade places. Paul Ryan, you can come work the iron, and I'll go to D.C.
That's iron worker Randy Bryce announcing his Democratic challenge to House Republican Speaker Paul Ryan in southeastern Wisconsin. Now, as much as there's talk of all of these Democratic potential challenges to Republican incumbents, there's still a great deal of Democratic concern that House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi of California has been around too long and created too much of a target for those Democratic candidates. Here's Ohio Democratic Congressman Tim Ryan telling CNN's Don Lemon that Pelosi is toxic for Democrats in some parts of the country.
She's been getting pounded now for 10 years with negative ads from the Republicans. I don't think it's fair, but clearly these ads using her, linking her to the, our candidates, is still working. I mean, I wish it wasn't true.
Nancy Pelosi is more toxic than Donald Trump?
You know what? The honest answer is, in some areas of the country, yes, she is. That's the honest answer.
Now, last week also saw President Donald Trump confirming what many people suspected. He doesn't have any tapes of conversations with the man he fired, former FBI Director James Comey. Trump says his tweet warning of the possibility of tapes did have an effect on Comey's testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee. This is what Trump had to say in an interview with Fox News.
Well, I didn't tape him. You never know what's happening when you see that the Obama administration, and perhaps longer than that, was doing all of this unmasking and surveillance, and you read all about it, and I've been reading about it for the last couple of months about the seriousness of the and horrible situation with surveillance all over the place, and you've been hearing the word unmasking, a word you probably never heard before. So you never know what's out there. But I didn't tape, and I don't have any tape, and I didn't tape. But when he found out that that there may be tapes out there, whether it's governmental tapes or anything else, and who knows, I think his story may have changed. I mean, you'll have to take a look at that, because then he has to tell what actually took place at the events.
That's President Trump explaining what he meant in that tweet that James Comey better worry about that. I don't have tapes of this. And of course, there were no tapes. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking to State Senator Jason Barrickman, Republican from Bloomington.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio on North Michigan Avenue. A beautiful sunny day. I hate it. It's almost 60 degrees. It's not nippy out, but it's just a little bit cool given some of the days that we've seen here. But it's a beautiful day. I know Schwani's talking about possible storms coming later this afternoon and today, but enjoy the sunshine while you can out there. Continuing our spin through the national news, in that Fox interview that we played a clip from before the news break, President Trump raised issues of fairness involving special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election. Here's the president on Robert Mueller.
Well, he's very, very good friends with Comey, which is very bothersome, but he's also, we're going to have to see. I mean, we're going to have to see in terms, look, there has been no obstruction. There has been no collusion. There has been leaking by Comey, but there's been no collusion, no obstruction, and virtually everybody agrees to that. So we'll have to see. I can say that the people that have been hired are all Hillary Clinton supporters. Some of them worked for Hillary Clinton. I mean, the whole thing is ridiculous, if you want to know the truth from that standpoint. But Robert Mueller's an honorable man, and hopefully he'll come up with an honorable solution.
So last week also saw the president, who had called Russian interference in the election a, quote, democratic hoax, unquote, on Thursday, now saying that Obama knew about Russian interference and didn't do anything to stop it. The White House did not explain the president's contradiction. Speaking of the FBI, by the way, CBS News has confirmed a report from Politico magazine that former Democratic presidential candidate and independent Senator Bernie Sanders and his wife Jane Sanders have hired prominent defense attorneys amid an FBI investigation into a loan that Jane Sanders obtained to expand Burlington College when she was its president. The push for a land acquisition by the college under Mrs. Sanders, a liberal arts college, put the school into debt, and eventually the school was shut down in 2016. So that's some of what's going on in the national news, and it seems like the FBI is pretty busy on both sides of the coin these days. Well, joining me now is State Senator Jason Berrickman, Republican from Bloomington. And Senator Berrickman's been very involved in the efforts to rewrite the state's school funding formula for providing adequate funding for school districts, the more than 800 school districts in the state of Illinois. And Senator Berrickman is author of a Republican version of a bill that Democrats have passed, a Democratic version of their bill, and that bill has passed both chambers. Senator Berrickman is arguing that his bill represents a more fundamental fairness. Senator, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Yeah, Rick, thanks for having me. I always enjoy your show.
I appreciate it. Perhaps you could start out by just explaining what the differences are between the two bills, the Democratic bill and the Republican bill.
Sure. And just, you know, we talk about things like equity and things that, you know, to some people start scratching their head and saying, you know, what are we even talking about? This is the problem of the school funding formula that exists today. We all know that the education that's afforded to students around the state is really determined by your zip code, right? So where you live determines the quality of your education, because Illinois relies on property taxes to fund their schools. So there's been an ongoing debate, a lot of history to our efforts to fix that formula and put resources in the districts that need it the most, the districts that maybe don't have the ability to tax themselves locally and provide the resources they need, districts that have lots of students who grow up in poverty or low-income households. So that's really the problem that we're trying to fix, Rick. And I think what you see today is that there's wide agreement among Republicans and Democrats. Their bills use the same language as our bills as to how you fix that. The essence of it is you follow the data. You use what's called an evidence-based funding model.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but that term has been tossed around a lot, and I'm just wondering, what does that mean? An evidence-based model.
Yeah, I mean, the education community has come forward nationwide and said, here's the 27 data elements that one needs to follow and incorporate to a funding formula. And without getting into all the nitty-gritty of it, a lot of it is things that we all know as parents and people who care about our schools. You know, it's things like classroom size matters. The data tells you that in a third grade classroom, if you pair one teacher with 15 students, you're going to have the best likelihood that those students are going to receive a high quality education. So it's 27 pieces of data just like this. And that's why I say, Rick, there's no disagreement among the two political parties about using that data and that model. The disagreement really comes down to two fundamental questions that relate to the Chicago public school system. It relates to whether or not the state of Illinois picks up Chicago's pensions, and whether or not the state of Illinois continues a set-aside that exists under current law, a set-aside that's valued at about $250 million that benefits the Chicago public school system in a manner that does not affect any other school district in the state.
That's the so-called block grant, that 250.
That's right.
And that's right. So the difference is how the Senate Bill 1 treats Chicago versus how your bill, Senate Bill 1124, treats Chicago.
Yeah, I mean, the Senate Bill 1, the Democrat version that passed on a partisan vote, and for which the Democrats are holding now, although they're asking the governor to sign it, even though they haven't actually sent that legislation to the governor. But the key difference, yes, of the two plans is that their plan gives to Chicago everything that Chicago is asking for. They do it in a manner that affects every other school district in the state and treats Chicago differently than every other school district. Our plan really says, let's create a fair system for all the school districts and for all the school children of the state. And as a result, our plan benefits the Chicago public school system. It recognizes that there's a need that exists there. It recognizes that the state has an obligation there, but it treats Chicago in a fair way as you compare it to every other school district. On the data, Chicago is helped by our formula. We simply don't manipulate the data in an effort to boost the funding help that goes to Chicago in a disproportionate or unfair manner.
We're speaking with State Senator Jason Berrickman, Republican from Bloomington, talking about the school funding issue and competing versions of trying to take care of the long-time problem of how our schools and the lack of state support for schools, basically the quality of education determined by the zip code and where you live. We'll be right back with more after this. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio. Joining me on the phone is Republican State Senator Jason Berrickman from the 53rd District. He's from Bloomington. We're talking about the various plans, looking at how to reform the way that the state funnels money to its public schools, and ideally with a long-term goal, I think everybody agrees with, of trying to reduce the burden of property taxes as a primary source for funding our public schools. Senator, one of the things I'm curious about is, you know, in the decades of discussion over trying to change school funding in Illinois, the issue has always been haves and have-nots and money being shifted from wealthier districts to poorer districts, losers and winners. Both of these plans try to address this through the concept of hold harmless. But I know that in yesterday's hearing in the House, there were concerns raised about, districts are held harmless, but that the Republican bill contains a phase out of that hold harmless clause.
Yeah, so Rick, this is the one of the problems that arises when politicians start to mess with evidence-based plans like our funding formula. You know, politicians have created all kinds of manipulations to the formula that exists today. Over the years, the legislature has manipulated the formula. And then when people started stepping back and saying, how are we funding our schools? They're saying, well, this patchwork of manipulations, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't do the job that it was intended to do. So what I have continued to advocate for, Rick, is that we follow the formula, the evidence-based model in its pure form, and we not allow those political manipulations to distort what we're trying to do. You know, everyone, when this discussion of school funding really kicked off, everyone said our goal here is to address the inequities that exist in the system, the fact that state money is not getting in the hands of the districts that need it the most. And the way you start messing with and taking away the solution to the inequitable formula that we've advanced is by having politicians manipulate the data, whether it be through hold harmlesses or otherwise. So we've tried to advance a fair and reasonable approach that recognizes that there's different priorities, some reflected by Democratic lawmakers, some by Republicans. We've really incorporated many of those ideas into legislation. It's not really, even though it's a plan put forward by a Republican, it's not the Republican plan. It's a combination of ideas that have advanced by a lot of leading Democrats and Republicans on this issue. Both sides have lots of good ideas. Both sides represent different constituencies. When you take all of that work product, the good ideas advanced by both parties, you really come up with a better formula, a formula that attacks the inequities in a better way. And here's how that's measured, Rick. The State Board of Education, for our analysis of these bills, the State Board of Education runs our formula through a simulation and says, here's the effect that it has on school districts with lots of students living in poverty and school districts who don't have an ability to pay for their schools locally. That's data-driven. And if you look at the data, what you see is that the plan advanced by us that combines the ideas of Republicans and Democrats actually does a better job of attacking the inequity than the plan advanced by Democrats. And so if you get past the sound bites and the rhetoric of, you know, of that's part of the political process, but you actually follow the data and say, if our goal is to fix the inequities and you look at what the data says on those inequities, what you realize is that there's a better way forward. That's the bill that we've put forward. We hope that the Democrats will consider it. It's a plan that's good for the Chicago public school system. It provides more money and more resources to them, but it does it in a fair and balanced way and recognizes that Chicago's not the only school district that needs state help. We've got a lot of school districts. When you look in the deep, you know, the southern part of our state, we have some of the highest areas of poverty in southern Illinois. No one's talking about those school districts because of the size of Chicago, but it's only fair that if taxpayers around the state are going to create a new funding system, that it be one that helps not only the kids in the Chicago, but the kids that need help in every other pocket of our state.
I'm curious why these numerous education-related groups have said SB1, the Democrat-passed plan, is their preferred plan. And not just school groups, but school districts, those kinds of organizations and advocates, why are they siding with the Democrat-passed version versus your version?
Well, it's interesting. I sat in a panel. They have you've talked about the Committee of the Whole that has been engineered by Speaker Madigan over in the House to discuss various issues. Yesterday, there was discussion of the education funding. And I sat on one of the panel with some of the advocates afterwards. I saw some of the other advocates. And what's interesting here is, you know, many of the advocates, to their credit, want a solution. They're like the voters around the state who kind of, you know, are very frustrated by the stalemate that exists in Springfield. And as a result, there's this desire held by many people, myself included, that we want solutions. We want the bipartisan bickering to stop. The advocates, you know, as I discussed with them yesterday, the advocates say, hey, we like your bill. We like that your legislation puts forward what seem to be good compromises that attempt to bring the two sides together. And I believe the advocates know as well that in a divided government, that's what we've really got. We've got a Republican governor. We've got a Democrat-controlled legislature. In a divided government, the only way solutions are advanced are when the two sides come together. And in reality, the Senate Bill 1 that was advanced is a work product of Democrats. It's an example of where I believe the Democrats walked away from the negotiating table in late May when we were having very good and positive talks in the Senate. The Democrats walked away from those negotiations. They advanced their own legislation here. The governor has said he's going to veto that Senate Bill 1. And so the onus is on all of us to come back to the table, the lawmakers, the stakeholders, the education community. And if you talk to the education community, they say exactly that, which is we need a solution. We don't need rallies and political rhetoric. We need something that can be signed into law. We know Senate Bill 1 is not that because the governor is going to veto it. But we know that our legislation that, again, incorporates the good ideas of both sides, that legislation has an opportunity to become law. And so I think what we're going to see, Rick, is more focused attention on this proposal and others that reflect priorities of both parties, because we know that's the only way we change the law and get something done and advanced in Springfield.
Regardless of what might eventually become law, to truly have this have any effect is going to require an appropriation and a sizable appropriation for education. Here we are in our continuing special session with no sign towards any resolution. How likely do you think we get there? Because it's great to talk about this, and this is, frankly, in decades of covering state government, to see this much progress towards trying to address what's known as one of the most inequitable school funding system in the United States. But at the same time, without an appropriation, it doesn't mean anything.
Well, and here's where, you know, when I introduced this education funding bill, Republicans, we also introduced a budget bill. It's designed to be a compromise reflecting, again, priorities of Democrats and Republicans. We put that out there over, you know, a week and a half or two ago. That budget, when you use this formula that we've advanced with that budget advanced by Republicans, number one, every school district in the state sees more money. Chicago will see $119 million more money if we pass the compromise budget advanced by Republicans and this compromise formula advanced by Republicans. Admittedly, the governor has campaigned on and continually said that as part of a compromise, a package of reforms to our state, he's willing to support and put Republican votes on a revenue increase.
Are those more important than education reform?
Well, no, I think these things come together. When the governor says that he wants to reform the system and he's willing to put more money into it with the reforms, one of those reforms is education funding reform. And so that's why it's important that, you know, the Democrats here want to talk about the tax increases and they want to make sure the tax increases are there to spend more money. We want to reform the system so that if more money is spent on things like schools, that we're actually solving problems, like getting the money into the school districts that most need them. And this is where I think you're hearing from Republicans, you're hearing from President Cullerton, that there's a lot of plans out there on the table, and the one person we've not yet heard from is Speaker Madigan. And you and I know the Speaker is notorious for chiming in at the 11th hour We know that next week is a critical, or this coming week is a critical week for our state. Our fiscal year ends on Friday. And my hope is that the speaker really engages us here in these negotiations, that he comes forward and says, I'm willing to help. The man, the gentleman, has lots of influence on his caucus and the legislative process. And it's time that he use that influence to help our state move forward. We all know that if there's going to be a solution, Speaker Madigan's going to be a part of it. That really, you know, that might rub Republicans the wrong way from time to time, but it is the reality of the system today. He's the speaker. He has an opportunity to have incredible influence. And what you're hearing from Democrats in the Senate and Republicans around the state is that it's time for Speaker Madigan to come forward with his ideas and demonstrate whether he's willing to come to the table and engage as an honest broker in a good faith negotiation to get the job done and advance things like the school funding bill, a balanced budget, and beyond.
That's State Senator Jason Berrickman, Republican from Bloomington. Senator, thank you so much for joining me this morning on the Sunday Spin.
Thank you, Rick. I really appreciate it.
We'll be back with more right after this.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. Last week saw Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger of Shanahan issue another warning that the president should be careful about his tweeting habits. Kinzinger told CNN that he didn't like Trump tweets attacking Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, or on Robert Mueller, the special counsel.
So I don't like this. I don't like any attempts to discredit people, especially through Twitter. I'm uncomfortable with that. I think it's wrong. I think Robert Mueller is a great American that served his country very well and is going to continue to serve his country in this unfortunate capacity. I think President Trump needs to remember other presidents have survived special counsels. When you think about President Clinton's situation, what he did very well was instead of focusing on his investigation against him, he kept repeating that he has work to do for the American people and basically turned public opinion in that process. I think President Trump would be well served right now to be focusing on the agenda that we have as Republicans in the House, which I think is very aggressive and good for the economy, to focus on his successes on foreign policy and let the investigation work its way. And then, you know, we'd have other things to talk about than this, but when you tweet about it every morning, this is the front of every newspaper and every 24-hour news cycle because it's just natural that it would be.
That's Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger from Shanahan. Now, joining me on the phone is Democratic State Representative Lou Lang from Skokie. He's the Deputy Majority Leader in the Illinois House. Representative, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Always great to be with you, Rick. Good morning.
Good morning. So here we are, another day of special session, another day of Committee of the Whole meetings. Is there any progress as we approach kind of this June 30th, the latest deadline that we face?
I don't think there's any public progress, but I do think there's private progress. There's a lot of people talking to each other who haven't been regular, ordinary members of the House, if you will, particularly on the Republican side, who are starting to believe that this must end and that a budget is paramount and we can't hold it to a standard of we have to get everything we want. The thing that would change this the most efficiently is if the governor would involve himself in these negotiations, in these conversations, in a way that he hasn't. And so in my tenure in the House, after budget hearings, et cetera, in the end, it's always been four legislative leaders in a room with the governor where a budget has been hammered out. And the governor doesn't want to enter that room because he doesn't want to wear the jacket for any decisions. He doesn't want to make these decisions. He would rather have this bounce around. His own public schedule this weekend shows that the governor really has no public appearances at all, not in the Capitol. One quick stop at an African-American church this morning. And at the end of that schedule, it says no press availability is available. And so the governor's not interested in engaging in this process. And I don't want to throw blame, but I have to tell the truth. And so the actual truth is that once he decides to negotiate a budget, there will be one. The only other alternative is to have a whole bunch of Republicans in the Illinois House of Representatives say, Governor, we don't care anymore what you think. We're just going to negotiate this with our Democratic colleagues and put it on your desk. And that could happen.
Well, let me ask you about the fact that, and we had Senate President John Cullerton on the show last week, and we've seen this kind of ramping up of efforts on the Republican side, that Senate Democrats have passed a budget over to the House, their version of a budget, and a budget package. Then you have the Republicans that came in with their proposal, both House and Senate Republicans, all of this trying to basically put House Speaker Michael Madigan in a box, and where is the Speaker's budget?
So everyone in the building knows that House Democrats have been working on a budget. Everybody in the building who knows anything knows what it looks like, and everybody knows it's not that far off from what the Senate Democrats have proposed. These are the things we've been talking about with our Republican colleagues in the House, some of whom may be ready to break from the governor, some of whom won't. We could have this accomplished in 2 days if the governor would simply sit down and say, you know, Democrats, you've given me a lot. I had a long list of items on my turnaround agenda. You've compromised on quite a few of them. And I think I should declare a win and tell the people of Illinois that I got all these things from you. And now we should do a budget. But he's not willing to do that. His own education advisor said that when we passed a bill that Mr. Berrickman was talking about just a little bit ago on your show, passed a bill to reform our education funding formula. She said, well, the governor's going to veto that because he's only getting 90% of what he wants. Now, Rick, you've been around a long time. Our listeners are not stupid. They know that 90% is pretty good batting average in Springfield. And yet, they're not satisfied with the education funding bill that is on the governor's desk because they want to stick it to the city of Chicago. And until they get what they want, they're not going to relent on that either.
But realistically, given the Democratic caucus and the Democratic caucus in both the House and Senate, given its makeup, without addressing the financial issues in Chicago, any kind of educational change is a non-starter. Isn't that correct?
Well, the Senate Bill 1, which is on the governor's desk, is a pretty good piece of legislation. Not any bill we pass that's complicated, that affects the entire state of Illinois, that impacts the distribution of dollars is perfect. And certainly one person can look at it and think it's not fair, and the next person can. But the fact is that the bill that was put on the governor's desk is fair across the state. The witnesses, most of the witnesses at the committee hearing yesterday testified to that. There were a couple of school superintendents from downstate that said they preferred the bill we put on the governor's desk, even though their school district might get a few more dollars from the Republican version, because they want fairness. They understand that every child in the state is entitled to a good quality education, even kids in the city of Chicago.
So it's the geographic bashing game is what you're saying.
Well, I think so, but I also think there's a lot veiled behind what the governor says regarding his view of the city of Chicago. And so oftentimes in the last couple of years, the governor has vetoed bills or turned his thumbs down on ideas that would help the city of Chicago. Oftentimes it's followed with, well, I'll do those things for you as long as you do these things for me. And so what he does here in the education portion of this is the threatened veto of Senate Bill 1, our education funding formula bill, is really an insult to the parents and the school children in the city of Chicago, because that's the only reason they're opposed to it, because they believe the city of Chicago gets too much. But the objective witnesses yesterday said, no, this is a fair funding formula for all school districts in the state of Illinois.
We're speaking with Democratic State Representative Lou Lang of Skokie, the Deputy Majority Leader in the Illinois House. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. (312) 981-7200 is our phone number. This is the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio on North Michigan Avenue. And joining me on the phone is Democratic State Representative Lou Lang, the House Democratic Deputy Leader. Representative, I'm curious about, as we approach this end of the state budget year, the prospect of a new budget year without, again, a full state budget, increasing talk about how Illinois may find itself as the first state in modern times to find its credit rating in junk status. The fact that if Illinois, as a state government, goes into junk credit status, that also takes down a number of local and other types of bonding. Is that pressure point actually being felt?
Certainly that pressure point is being felt, along with the end of road construction projects, along with schools perhaps not opening, along with our state universities and our human service infrastructure crumbling before us. This could all be resolved if the governor would decide to enter the budget negotiations.
So why do you think he doesn't enter the budget negotiations? I mean,
I don't think he's really interested in governing. I know that sounds nuts to people who are listening, who read the papers, and the governor stays on script every day. But in my years here, and there have been quite a few of them, we've had a budget under every governor, Democratic and Republican. There's always been a budget. Some people would say they aren't always the greatest budgets. Fine. But that we're here today with a governor who won't engage in the budget process. We have asked him numerous times to do so. The speaker empowered four leaders, including myself, to go to the governor's office and have a discussion with him. He refused to meet with us. Just the other day, the governor refused the speaker when the speaker asked him to come to a meeting. And then the speaker created a meeting with the four legislative leaders, and the governor eventually convinced the Republican leaders not to go to the meeting. These are facts. Now, I'm sure Mr. Brady, who's on after me, will dispute those facts. Fine. But these are the facts. And, you know, to people who are listening, and people who read the papers and people who hear all this noise, it just sounds like the blame game. But all I can do is answer a question truthfully. All we can do is tell you what's going on. And people will say, well, we really don't care. We don't care about all your machinations down there. We need a budget. And, you know, we do need a budget.
And to do a budget is going to take new revenue, and the Senate Democrat passed plan is higher income taxes, extends some service taxes to some amount of services. But given the fact that we're so well into the 2018 election cycle this early, there's a belief that neither side wants to be responsible for passing on a tax increase that would have to be needed.
I think if you talk to every member of the House and Senate privately, even members of the House and Senate who will never vote for a tax increase, they would tell you we need more revenue. We cannot possibly balance the books of the state of Illinois without more revenue. One of the most serious blunders was allowing the recent income tax increase, when it went to 5%, to revert back to 3.75%. That tax never should have been temporary. It should have been permanent. Why? Because if you look at the numbers, we wouldn't have $15 billion in back bills today. In fact, shortly after that tax expired, the bills began to mount. But before that, we were paying our bills. So before we passed that income tax increase, we owed about $9 billion, had shrunk it to about $3 billion with a plan to get flush, a plan to get even. And then the governor vetoed the budget we passed 2 years ago. And in that process, the state income tax reverted, cost us several billion dollars a year in revenue. And here we are with the state comptroller announcing that we're $15 billion backlogged on our bills, and we have to figure out a way to pay those. Providers aren't being paid. Services aren't being provided. And believe me when I tell you that every member of the House and Senate, all 177, both chambers, both sides of the aisle, want a budget.
I actually have a text from earlier where someone wanted to know why the Democrats allowed that tax to phase down when there was, at that time, still a Democratic governor and full control of the House and Senate.
Well, you still needed to find sufficient votes to do it. So some of the people that say, why didn't you Democrats do that, are some of the same people who would say, how come your Democrats are always in lockstep? How come you never separate yourself from the Speaker and your Democratic governor? So some of the same people go on both sides of that fence. I'm one that said it should have been permanent. I'm one that believes, if you look at the numbers, that we would not be in the sorry shape we are today if we had done that. But, you know, looking backwards is slightly instructive, but it doesn't help us where we are today. Where we are today is a big mess, and a mess that needs to be resolved, which is why I'm hopeful that if the governor won't engage, that members will take this into their own hands and do something about this. And I can assure you that conversations are taking place on a daily basis. So while people don't necessarily see that on the House floor or the Senate floor, a lot of conversation going on, some of it fruitful, some of it not. This is very difficult stuff. It would be less difficult if the governor of the state of Illinois would stick his nose in the room every once in a while and do what every other governor has done and say, I have the responsibility to lead. I have the responsibility to take this to the goal line. And whatever obstacles are in my way, I'm going to do it.
To pass the tax increase and the revenue that would be needed to balance a budget would take 71 votes. There's 67 Democrats, and that doesn't mean all of them would necessarily vote on a tax increase. But how many Republican votes of the Republican minority are needed as far as a structured roll call to try to pass something like that?
I'm not so sure we're worried about a structured roll call. And to listeners who don't know what that means, a structured roll call is where everybody purposely sits down and decides, well, Democrats will put so many votes on, Republicans will put so many votes on, and we'll get to the magic number. I think there's still a lot of talk about how many GOP members are willing to join the majority in accomplishing the goal of getting to the budget. And if we have sufficient numbers, we will move forward. But I don't have a specific number for you. It's certainly more than a few, but we'll just have to see where this goes.
That's Democratic State Representative Lou Lang of Skokie. He is the Deputy House Democratic Leader of the Illinois House. Representative, thank you so much for joining me this morning. And I know that work begins again in Springfield in just a few hours.
Thanks, Rick. Always good to be with you. Have a great day.
We'll be back with more right after this. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking to Bill Brady. He's the deputy Republican leader of the Illinois Senate, a senator from Bloomington, and he is substituting for Senate Republican leader Christine Redonio, who unfortunately had to attend to duties of the Senate this morning. So we'll be speaking to Bill Brady coming up.
Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. The in-town travel pool traveling with the President of the United States says that about 20 minutes ago, they headed out of the White House, destination imaginable on a muggy summer Sunday morning in the D.C. area. The pool saw the president in golf clothes, and he appeared to be with an older man, companion, also in golf attire. Agents are dressed in their khakis and plaid baggy short-sleeve shirts, attire accessorized with ball caps, and one was just practicing a pantomimed golf swing in the driveway. But, of course, no official word where the President of the United States is headed on this Sunday morning. I assume we'll get more details, but maybe not, because the White House has been reluctant to say that when the president visits his golf properties that he's actually playing golf. One thing last Sunday, one of the president's private attorneys in the investigation, in multiple investigations, appeared with Chris Wallace on Fox News. And Jay Sekulow said the president wasn't under investigation for obstruction of justice. But Sekulow also said Trump was under investigation. You listen, and as Fox says, you decide.
The president takes action based on numerous events, including recommendations from his attorney general and the deputy attorney general's office. He takes the action that they also, by the way, recommended, and now he's being investigated by the Department of Justice because the special counsel under the special counsel regulations reports still to the Department of Justice, not an independent counsel. So he's being investigated for taking the action that the attorney general and deputy attorney general recommended him to take by the agency who recommended the termination. So that's the constitutional threshold question here. That's why, as I said,
What's the question? I mean, you stated some facts. First of all, you've now said that he is being investigated after saying that you didn't.
No.
You just said that he's being investigated.
No, Chris, I said that the let me be crystal clear so you completely understand. We have not received, nor are we aware of any investigation of the President of the United States.
Sir, you just said two times that he's being investigated.
No. The context of the tweet, I just gave you the legal theory, Chris, of how the Constitution works.
And so you decide what he said. The tape's the tape. I mean, so we'll just watch this all play out. Well, joining me now on the phone is Republican of Bloomington, Republican Senator Bill Brady. He's the deputy Republican leader of the Illinois Senate. And Senator Brady, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Rick, it's good to be with you again.
So we've kind of, here we are, it's Sunday. Special session is in process, as it were. I don't know about progress. Are you seeing any progress being made down there?
What I'm hearing in my discussions, and I think Representative Lang said it earlier, there are a lot of discussions going on. The progress is being made. The governor was right to call us back. The House is finally having to take up the issues of importance that the Senate's been working on for several months under the leadership of our leader, Chris Redonio, and President Culleton. We came so very, very close to finalizing a deal. Since we adjourned, the governor has joined our efforts in what we're calling a capital compromise. House Republicans have joined the efforts that Senate Democrats and Senate Republicans have worked on. Now it's time for the House. And I think Leader Durkin, as I spoke to him yesterday, has said that he believes progress is being made in the communications that are going in the House, and that needs to continue to be pursued.
Now, it's my understanding that House Republican Leader Durkin and House Speaker Madigan have agreed to talk and discuss further on the issue of workers' compensation, which I know is one of the prerequisites for achieving some kind of resolution to this, but that seems to be a significant step.
A couple weeks ago when I met with Leader Durkin on some things, he'd said flatly that I asked him, "Are you and Speaker Madigan communicating?" He said, "No, the Speaker won't return my phone calls, won't do anything." But so the progress, the fact that the Speaker appears to be communicating and having his emissaries do that is a positive step. As I said, three caucuses and the governor are in step to solve this crisis. We just need the House Republicans, the House Democrats, to come to the table.
Well,
it appears they have been in this last week, and that the governor was right to force the issue by calling us back. It's unfortunate he had to, but he was right to do it.
Well, and the question I still have, though, is, you know, there is a great deal of distrust down in Springfield. And, you know, you even heard the from Representative Lang say the issue of Madigan wanting to have a leaders meeting of the four leaders, and that it was the governor that pulled the Republican leaders out of that. That's something that the governor denies. That
I think it's even something Jim Durkin.
Well, Jim Durkin said that he just wanted to have a one-on-one meeting with Madigan, similar to the way that Senator Redonio met with Senate President Cullerton, and try and work it in these kind of bilateral conversations, because we might as well talk diplomatic speak when it comes to Springfield these days, which might be the only diplomacy that's going on. But the fact that you have these accusations, whatever, being hurled, truly represent a mindset that exists of you can't trust Speaker Madigan, you can't trust the governor. How do you bridge that trust gap?
Well, I don't see it as a trust gap. I see a lot of theater, a lot of drama, and then the reality. I think everyone knows they can trust the governor. I think people, it's not a lack of trust with the speaker as much as just getting him to do something and not be political. So I don't think there's really a trust gap as much as people are using that as an excuse, maybe to be political. But the governor has made a commitment. He said, I support this plan. This is the plan, the Capitol Compromise, that I want the Senate Democrats and Senate Republicans under Leader Redonio and John Cullerton, the president, worked so hard on. We made some additional concessions that we weren't willing to make as Senate Republicans to the Senate Democrats in the Capitol Compromise. We've put it on the table. The House Republicans have joined in their support. The governor's joined in his support. So it's a political question. Are the House Democrats willing to set aside some political motivations for the good of the state? And the Senate Democrats are, which I applaud Senator Cullerton for doing. And so the way I look at it, it's not necessarily a trust issue. I don't find anyone faulting or not trusting each other. It's, are they willing to come to the table and put a plan together that moves this state forward?
You don't think that there's mistrust, that Democrats don't trust that when the governor says, here's the Republican proposal, I will sign it? You don't think there are some Democrats who don't believe the governor when he says that?
I don't know why they wouldn't. I mean, the governor is putting a state in front of, in the forefront. And for him to come out, and actually, it was the governor who said to us, and I, under Leader Redonio's authority, I negotiated some things. It was the governor who said, let's give some of these, what did the Democrats want in the Senate? Let's make some of these concessions in addition to what you were willing to make before. We agreed to it. And I think the governor's been very forthright. So I think it's just political excuse if they want to use that. But we've got a real solution on the table that has been agreed to by three caucuses and the governor. I think Representative Durkin, Leader Durkin, is making good progress in communication with the speaker. And hopefully that will resolve itself into a real solution. That's what we need.
We're speaking with Republican State Senator Bill Brady. He's the Deputy Republican Leader of the Illinois Senate. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. We're speaking with Deputy Republican Leader of the Illinois Senate, Bill Brady from Bloomington. Senator, I know you kind of dismiss talk of mistrust existing there, but I want to basically read you this text that I got, that it really doesn't matter which party. The people of the state just don't believe either side, and it does kind of seem like all this is just a blame game.
Well, as I said, there's a drama and theater in politics, but the reality is we've worked very hard in a very bipartisan way. I think Senator Cullerton would be the first, president of the Senate, Democrat, would be the first to say that Senator Leader Redonio and he worked with our members. There's no blame in the Senate. We came up with a good solution that we were very, very close to. And as I said, there's no blame here. It's a blueprint. It's a public document. There's education reform. There's tax relief in the form of a freeze. There's a balanced budget with spending caps. This isn't a blame game. This is a real program that creates jobs through reforms and provides term limits on legislative leaders. These are all things that we've come to bipartisan agreement on in the Senate, by and large. And we just want the House to get engaged. Now, it appears they are. They're doing their committees of the whole. They're negotiating, as I understand it, with the leader Durkin and his colleagues. So I don't look at it as a blame game. And no one's going to win by blaming anybody else. We need a solution. The people, I understand, are cynical because of the drama in the theater, but we're working hard. As Leader Lang said earlier, a lot of communication is going on. We need to be in Springfield. We need to be doing the job and come with a solution. That's what people want.
What do you say when people take a look at, you know, here we are in already very much engulfed into 2018 election year politics this early, but that you look at the governor with him being up for re-election next year, you look at the fact of all of the House, a good number of seats in the Senate up for election, that the political will to not want to pass a tax increase, or as even the governor put out in one of his campaign mailings, the fact that he's been able to block a tax increase, that neither side has a political appetite to pass a very politically difficult tax increase.
Well, clearly there's an election that's forthcoming. But let me just say this. We realize that property taxes are the biggest burden on the taxpayers of Illinois. We realize we need a balanced budget. Property taxes in the state of Illinois are the highest of any in the nation. And what the governor has fought for, what I have fought for, Republicans, is property tax relief. If we're going to ask taxpayers for temporary resources, then we need parity with property tax relief, the biggest burden they're facing. And that's what's a key component to this whole thing. And I think what makes it a political win for everybody, not to mention the taxpayers, the property tax relief that we're talking about here is billions of dollars. It will really reset the gauge on how people look at Illinois. So we came up with a plan, Senator Colleton and Leader Redonio, a plan to bring parity to some extent between property tax relief and temporary additional revenues to balance this fiscal crisis. So I think there is the wherewithal that people are willing to set aside future election fears for a real solution in Illinois.
Haven't we gotten so deep in the hole, though, that to get ourselves out of this, that to talk of any kind of a temporary income tax increase is just kind of a fanciful talk? I mean, we're
not at all. One of the components of this plan is a spending cap. One of the failures of the Quinn income tax increase was that he didn't use the money to pay down a backlog of unpaid bills and control spending. This uses resources to pay down the backlog of unpaid bills and control spending.
Well, the backlog of unpaid bills did go down during that period. Plus, the state finally picked up its share of the pension costs, which hadn't been done.
Right. That failed plan called for a temporary tax increase, the idea was they would control spending so that it would be able to fall off and have a balanced budget. What this plan calls for, and this is a key component, if you go 4 years, say you go 4 years with temporary revenues, 4 years with property tax freeze, and 4 years with a spending cap, which this calls for, that spending cap, that key component, provides for in that 4 year, at the end of that 4 years, revenues and expenditures are equal with the fall off of the temporary revenues. So this is a long-term plan that lives within its means and will live up to its promise to the people of Illinois.
But 4 years, that's not really long term, is it? I mean, well, given what it will take to bail our way out of this mess, I mean,
well, again, our plan provides for temporary borrowing that's paid back in the plan, and provides for projected revenues and expenditures that are in balance at the end of 4 years, allowing that tax, that temporary revenue, to fall off. So I think that's pretty long term in terms of a solution, certainly better than what the failed Quinn plan left us with. And we learned from that. We knew we needed business reforms to grow jobs. We knew we needed property tax relief to grow jobs and provide that relief. We knew we needed a spending cap that would last that term. So that's why this comprehensive plan brings us to a very successful conclusion if we can just get the House Democrats on board. As I said, the Senate Democrats are by and large with us on this plan as we negotiated it in the Senate.
And so Friday's the end of the state budget year. Give me your optimistic voice, like I believe you predicted we would have something by May 31st.
Well, I'd hope we would have something by May 31st. I can't control the gavel, and only the House Speaker can control that gavel. But I believe that there's a lot of pressure points here. If the Speaker fails to come to the table, we're looking at road projects shutting down, not only jobs but public safety. There's real pressure points here at the end of this month that need to be addressed. And I'm hoping we in the Senate hoped we could have a solution and we wouldn't be going through the drama of these pressure points. That's why we worked in a compromising way. That's what the governor's hoping that we build upon, and Leader Durkin's hoping we build upon. We just need the House Democrats. And I hate to say this, but it really is in their court. They have to come to the table and agree to something that we by and large, in a bipartisan way, have already come to terms with. So it's up to the Speaker. Leader Durkin's doing his best job, I think, to work. They are communicating. He sees progress, and hopefully they'll continue to see that progress in the House, and we will. And I'm optimistic that we will come to a conclusion. I think Lou Lang is right. People want a successful conclusion to this. Everyone wants a budget. We just need the House Democrats to pick up the mantle and help us get there.
That's Bill Brady. He's the Deputy Republican Leader of the Illinois Senate, a senator from Bloomington. Senator Brady, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Rick, good to be with you, and thanks to your listeners. And hopefully we'll have a happy 4th of July celebration with a balanced budget in Illinois.
Well, either way, we know there will be fireworks. That's for sure. Thank you, Senator Brady.
Thank you.
We'll be back with more right after this. Well, that's all we have time for on this week's edition of the Sunday Spin. I want to thank my guests, State Senator Jason Berrickman from Bloomington, Democratic Representative Lou Lang of Skokie, and State Senator Bill Brady of Bloomington. Most of all, I want to thank all of you out there. And now it's time for the great Dean Richards.
A little mini show today, a little two-hour show instead
really?
Of a full four. Brian Noonan's going to come in at 11 o'clock because I'm going to skedaddle out of here.
Oh, I bet I know where you're headed.
Headed to the Montrose and Broadway is where the annual Pride Parade steps off today. And both WGN TV and WGN Radio have floats in them. So since
excellent.
I,
and you'll work, be hopping?
I've arranged for a zip line between the
two. Oh, okay. I thought it might be like doing in between the rail cars on the CTA or
something.
Yeah,
that's that's so 1980. That's so 1980. We've got a zip line now. And,
cool.
But, you know, several of us who are by you. Let's see if you were on the float today because your Tribune radio and television. You'd really be ziplining.
No, thanks. My stomach is going to be churning enough from listening to the legislative session going on this afternoon in Springfield.
Speaking of ziplining.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
People dashing back and forth on their positions.
Yes.
So we'll keep
a little whiplash.
Keep everybody posted on what's going on with that. We've got a lot of fun planned this morning. Rick, have a great day today. Enjoy those politicians.